huge, probably some of the largest mines in North America if they go forward. And we want input because we have multi-million dollar fisheries on the U.S. side.
Southeast fishing groups want a say in proposed mines for British Columbia. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the rush in Alaska to sign up for health insurance before the deadline.
The appointments are filling up very quickly, so people need to call us.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Enjoy a lunchtime talk with Dennis Hayes, CEO of the world's most energy-efficient commercial building, on Thursday, May 1st, during the 6th Annual Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference at the Dena'ina Center. Individual tickets for this keynote luncheon can be purchased at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. Clean energy, it's everyone's business. This message sponsored by REAP.
While the legislature is still hammering out how much money to put toward the base student allocation, the Senate Finance Committee has included a major injection of funds in their version of the operating budget. Where the House had proposed giving school districts $25 million in one-time education aid, the Senate Finance Committee has bumped that number up to $100 million to be divided among school districts based on their enrollment numbers. Their operating budget would allocate $100 million to schools during the 2015-16 academic year as well. Senator Pete Kelly, a Fairbanks Republican who co-chairs the committee, says the number serves as a placeholder while lawmakers figure out how they want to adjust the funding formula.
We want, as a group, to figure out education. We may need some time to do that. This amendment gives us time while we are not putting the school districts too much out on a limb as we make our determinations.
The number could change if the legislature settles on a more permanent fix for education funding by increasing the base student allocation. That's the amount that each school gets for every student enrolled, and it's sat at $5,680 per child for the past 4 years. Governor Sean Parnell has proposed increasing the BSA by $85 per student this year, which adds up to a little more than $10 million for the whole school system. His plan would build in future boosts to the BSA over the next couple of years. The Democratic minority in the legislature has argued that doesn't do enough to plug school districts' budget shortfalls and avoid teacher layoffs. Their legislation would increase the BSA by $400. The Senate operating budget will come to a vote next week and then be sent to the House so differences can be worked out. If you've ever been charged with a crime in Alaska, it's documented in an online database called CourtView that anyone can check. Landlords use it. Employers use it. Some people even use it while dating to see if their romantic partner has a criminal history. Soon, those searches could be limited to only cases where a guilty verdict has been reached. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Senator Fred Dyson's bill would make it so all criminal cases that result in a dismissal or an acquittal are considered confidential. They won't appear on the internet and you won't be able to access them at the courthouse unless you are a state worker who deals with child welfare. The Eagle River Republican presented it on the Senate floor as a justice issue.
This one is about amendments 4 and 5. Privacy and due process.
The rationale behind the bill is simple. If a jury does not find a person guilty of a crime, then that person should not be punished by the court of public opinion. The bill received broad support, passing on an 18-1 vote. Anchorage Democrat Hollis French, a former prosecutor, was the lone opponent. He says that in a state with such high levels of sexual assault and domestic violence, crimes that are difficult to convict, the legislature should err on the side of transparency in criminal cases.
Just say there's 1,000 assaults in a year. Out of those, you probably get 250 arrests, and out of those, you get 200 convictions. Well, what happens to all that information about those assaults? Neighbors will hear the screams and the cry, right? The children will see the bloody eyes. But what happens to that information? I'm not saying you have to report everything, but I think you have to be very careful when you start closing off public information.
The bill will now go to the House for consideration. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The head of British Columbia's government has pledged to spur mining development in the Western Canadian province, and that has fishermen in Southeast Alaska nervous. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, a group from Southeast flew to Washington, D.C. this week to see how it can raise its voice in Canada.
BC Premier Christy Clark is making good on a promise to break ground on 8 new mines and expand 9 others by next year. The increased activity has already brought more than 2,000 jobs to BC. Here's the Premier at a speech to a mining convention in January.
Well, if there's any doubt that here in British Columbia we are in favor of mining and the economic activity and the jobs that you create and the environmentally sustainable world-leading practices that you use to make it happen, I am going to dispel that now.
Clark then announced plans to continue a $10 million tax credit to help finance mineral exploration companies. The province has already streamlined its permitting process, cutting in half the turnaround time for one type of mining permit.
It has made a heck of a difference in raising revenue in British Columbia, and we're going to keep doing it.
British Columbia now has more than 20 major mines and expansions moving through the permitting process. The largest, known as the KSM mine, would be about 45 miles from Hyder, Alaska. Brian Lynch of the Petersburg Vessel Owners Association says his group isn't anti-mine, but they're wary of the KSM mine and at least 4 other proposed projects in BC that are upstream from Alaska waters.
They're huge, probably some of the largest mines in North America if they go forward. And we just have a great deal of concern. We want input because we have multi-million dollar fisheries on the U.S. side.
Lynch was part of a group of 5 Alaskans in Washington this week to ask for help from the State Department and the congressional delegation. Lynch says they're concerned BC regulators may not be able to keep up with the new pace of mining and that water quality and fish habitat may suffer. A spokesman for Senator Lisa Murkowski says she plans to raise the issue with Secretary of State John Kerry. The British Columbia Ministry of Environment declined several requests for an interview this week, saying it had no one available. But in an email, the ministry said an environmental assessment of KSM is underway and a decision is expected mid-year. The ministry says U.S. and Alaska state officials have participated in a technical working group that provides comments for that assessment. Dale Kelly, a Craig fisherman, came to Washington on behalf of the Alaska Trollers Association. She says they haven't been very involved in the Canadian process and have no particular reason to think they'd be rebuffed.
But they don't really have to listen to us. So I think it'd be nice to have a mechanism between the countries where, whether it's our state or our federal government, can actually weigh in and have some authority for ensuring that our interests are protected on the downstream side.
The two countries have an international joint commission to work out boundary water issues. Lynch says, as he understands it, the commission can't help until the threat occurs, and by then it's too late. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the vote in Seldovia after the 64 earthquake that forever changed the town.
The vote came in. It was pretty close. I don't remember how close, but it was pretty close. And, you know, Seldovia's just been dwindling ever since then.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. Registration is open for the Alaska Trails 2014 Trails Conference, April 24th through 26th in Anchorage. Agenda and more information at alaska-trails.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Trails.
The deadline to enroll for health insurance is March 31st. If you're still uninsured after that, you'll likely not be able to enroll until November. And you'll also have to pay a tax penalty. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Valerie Jarrett is a senior advisor to President Obama. Besides traveling to cities like Los Angeles and Phoenix to talk about the Affordable Care Act, she's also been given a list of 10 states to call. She says others in the administration have been given similar lists.
We don't want to wake up on April 1st and say, somebody didn't sign up because they hadn't heard about this opportunity.
The Obama administration wants to make sure that if you try to enroll for health care by March 31st, you will get it, even if you haven't quite finished the application process.
This is going to be on the honor system. People who just verify that they began the process but they hadn't had a chance to finish it yet will be given a reasonable period of time to complete it. We don't want to cut people off who are starting the process, particularly because we've seen a great increase in the traffic on our website just in the last couple of days.
Jarrett says 1.5 million people were on the healthcare.gov website on Wednesday. Even with the high traffic, Jarrett says the website is holding up really well.
But as more and more people are on the website, it's possible that you could have to wait for a bit.
Within Alaska, enrollment activity has also increased. At Enroll Alaska, Chief Operating Officer Tyann Bowling says staff and agents have been working 12 to 13-hour days, and they'll be working through the weekend.
The appointments are filling up very quickly, so people need to call us.
As of Monday, the healthcare broker enrolled over 1,900 people. The deadline to enroll for health insurance is 8 p.m. Monday. Bowling says Enroll Alaska agents will still be available after that for people who may experience a life-changing event.
Say if they lost a job or they lose coverage or they have a child or they get married, any of these life-changing events creates a special enrollment period where they can enroll.
And Enroll Alaska plans to work hard this summer, thinking of new ways to reach out to the uninsured for the next open enrollment period in November. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
The 1964 earthquake caused immediate devastation in many communities in south-central Alaska. In Seldovia, on Kachemak Bay, the story was different. The town didn't initially notice much damage from the disaster, but that changed when the spring high tides came in. Author Dana Stabenow was celebrating her 12th birthday with friends in Seldovia on March 27, 1964. She told KBBI's Aaron Selvig she was focused on opening her presents when the house started moving back and forth in a slow, steady motion.
The girls started getting a little excited. My mom said, "Everybody sit where you are." So boom, we sat back down and we just waited. And it went back and forth for quite a while and then it stopped. And everybody said, "Wow, that was a big one." And that's when the secondary motion kicked in, which is the jackhammer motion, up and down, really violent, really hard. And it seemed to go on forever. And the doors on the kitchen cabinets were opening and falling, stuff was falling out. And the refrigerator door slammed open and everything fell out. And my mother said, "Everybody outside." And we couldn't walk. The motion was so violent, it would knock us down if we didn't have, you know, we leaned up against the wall and sort of leaned our way out of the house. And then there were a couple of steps with a railing and we held onto the railing down. And I looked up and the trees in the yard were whipping back and forth. It was like Indiana Jones's whip, just whipping back and forth. And all I know, they say now, you hear people say that it lasted for 5.5 minutes. I'll tell you, it felt like 5.5 years. Then the mayor, then like, I think it was about 2 hours later, the mayor came knocking at the door and said, "Everybody up to the school because there's going to be a tidal wave." And I was standing outside the gym, staring down at the bay, which we couldn't see because it was dark. And I was holding my mom's best friend, Mika's hand, and listening to the tidal wave come in. It was this shh sound. I've never forgotten it. Seldovia was really lucky because the bay was sort of angled perpendicularly to the motion of the wave. So really all we got was the backwash. Plus we had a minus tide. So everybody's first floor got washed clean and the brand new small boat harbor got totally broken up. The fishermen were hauling slips back for weeks after the tidal wave. We didn't really know until the spring tides hit in April what our real problem was, and that was that the ground had fallen 5.5 feet. And so the high spring tides came in and was just, they were, you know, it was pulling the boardwalk out of the ground that it was, you know, the pilings were pounded into and the buildings as well.
There was no clue before that was going to be an issue?
No, there was no, we didn't know anything about it until the tides hit.
Wow.
And then we realized, oh my God. And they came up to the school. I guess, fifth or sixth grade? And the town fathers came up to the school. They pulled everyone out of the school from fifth grade on. Everybody younger got to stay in school, but the rest of us, they pulled out of school and they took us out to the outside beach and we filled sandbags for, God, I don't know how long, while the adults drove back and forth between the beach and town with the full sandbags to weight everything down so it wouldn't float away on the tide. So there was a big discussion in Saldovia after that about what we were going to do. So there were two options. The Army Corps of Engineers came in and suggested that thing that they do called dike and fill, which means blow up everything for gravel and, you know, fill in, build a dike and then fill in the dike and rebuild on that flatland. And other people wanted to bring in a pile driver and just raise the city up 5.5 feet. I shouldn't call it a city. It's a town. It might even be a village. But it was a really, really quaint and beautiful place. There were 2 miles of boardwalk and all the canneries, 5 canneries, and the buildings like the post office and the grocery store and everything, and the theater. We even haven't actually had a theater. We're all built alongside the boardwalk because the boardwalk is our main street. And they had an election in October, and there were, you know, feelings ran pretty hot. A lot of people had lived in Saldovia for an awful long time, and they really did not want the Army Corps of Engineers dike and fill option. My mother was very much against it. And the vote came in. It was pretty close. I don't remember how close, but it was pretty close. And the city voted for the dike and fill option. And, you know, Saldovia's just been dwindling ever since then.
May I ask you about that? What would have been the long-term effects from the Saldovia that you knew 50 years ago and what you see today when you go over there?
Well, the population is just shrinking. The student population in the school is shrinking. The grocery store just closed. The kids all leave because there's nothing there for them. There's not a lot left in Saldovia that was there. I mean, I won't say that it was vital and vibrant when I was a kid, but there were a lot more people there and there was a lot more going on. And then, of course, you know, the population doubled in the summertime when fishing for salmon. And then when Lowell Wakefield built the cannery there, of course, it went kaboom, kaboom through the winter as well, because at that time, the king crab season opened on August 1st and closed on May 1st. There's not a lot of hope for the... So I'm sure the city fathers today would tell you different, but it seems as if it has just been dwindling ever since. There's no industry there. There's no industry left there. There's no canneries left there.
Author Dana Stabenow talked to KBBI's Aaron Selvig about how the 64 earthquake damaged her hometown of Saldovia.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Emily Files. This week on AK, disaster response. The first responders in any disaster include firefighters and emergency medical technicians. Capital City Fire and Rescue and the International Firefighters Association recently held a unique event in Juneau, designed to demonstrate the rigors of the job to those unfamiliar with their routine. It was a golden opportunity for KTOO's Matt Miller. He got to play a firefighter for a whole day.
Many little boys and girls dream of becoming a firefighter. This is the first chance I've had to dress up as a fireman since running home to see after-school reruns of Squad 51's Gage and DeSoto.
Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R.
Yes.
Capital City Fire and Rescue Captain John Krebsbach says their day-long experience is designed to show local policymakers and the media how to operate an effective fire department in any community.
The purpose is to demonstrate the need for more staffing. That's the whole gist of it. There's 3 main points we're trying to get out of this whole thing: that our jobs are time sensitive, they're labor intensive, and highly technical.
I get to use all the usual firefighters' tools, the bunker or turnout gear, the boots, the helmet, fire-resistant hood, and the SCBA, or self-contained breathing apparatus. Those are the air packs used while entering a smoke-filled structure.
Okay, suck in. There you go.
I'm essentially wearing another 60 pounds. I've already climbed a truck ladder, operated a hose for defensive fire operations, used a chainsaw to ventilate a roof, and entered smoke-filled rooms to douse fires or find victims.
And I don't feel a pulse. So, Matt, I need you to start doing CPR on this guy.
But it's this next exercise that is the most revealing. It's a medical call. Something is wrong with the victim. We don't know anything about underlying health issues yet, but his heart has stopped.
All right. Hands up. Put your other hand on top of that.
We need to get it pumping again before we can get him into an ambulance for the trip to the hospital.
It's like this. One.
Career firefighter Eric Goldsbury and I are helping with initial care. We're not alone. Also responding in this scenario are an assembly member, a city employee, and a newspaper reporter and their shadows.
It's too slow, man.
Really?
EMT Travis Larson directs us to rotate positions, working with the heart monitor, administering medications, respirating the patient, and doing chest compressions.
Keep doing compressions until you're told to stop.
The victim is really a mechanical training dummy that provides feedback to the portable heart monitors.
Everyone's clear? Chuck delivered, back on CPR. Keep track of how many cycles.
It's my turn with the compressions, but I'm not going deep enough. I've lost count, and I have absolutely no rhythm.
20, 21, 22.
The patient is eventually stabilized, and we put him on a backboard to carry him out of the second floor room.
Imagine if this is a 350-pound man, how much harder that's going to be. Or if he was in a bathroom.
At 185 pounds, this patient may not be that heavy, but still, it's no wonder that firefighters frequently get injured on the job. Goldsbury says back injuries are at the top of the list.
Yep.
I get to step backward down the stairs, holding my end of the backboard as high as I can. At the bottom of the stairs, we put the backboard on a gurney, wheel it out the door, and into an ambulance for the trip to the hospital.
Oh, perfect. We're ready, Dave.
Is that lock in?
This is why you usually see a fire engine following an ambulance to a medical call in Juneau. CCFR says the number of EMTs and firefighters is only half what they need for the various apparatus. On the way to the hospital, Larson communicates with the staff there, while us four students bumble and fumble with administering medications and air or continuing compressions.
Just keep it constant.
I'm back at it, standing up while pumping away. The ambulance driver lets us know about potholes in most turns, but
left turn. Right.
A sharp turn, and I lose my balance, nearly falling completely on top of the patient. Finally, we arrive at the virtual hospital and get the patient inside.
Do you guys have any questions about
him? He's still alive?
Condition of the patient may be a little unclear, but I know for sure that I just got my butt kicked. What I don't know now is that I'll be stiff and aching all over tomorrow. Captain John Krebsbach says participants of earlier exercises in the lower 48 had similar reactions.
They're usually eye-opening. They didn't realize, you know, how involved the job actually is. You know, it is a hard job. It's physically demanding.
So much for my childhood fantasy. Playing firefighter was a serious reality check. This is not a job anyone can just walk into. I just experienced in a matter of hours a taste of what the normal entry-level firefighter goes through in a full year of training. For AK, I'm Matt Miller in Juneau.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading to Shishmaref on a barrier island in western Alaska. The island is gradually sinking into the sea. Its 600 residents might be some of the first people in the world forced to relocate because of rising sea levels caused by global warming.
My name is Tony Wilwana Sr., and I'm living in Shishmaref, Alaska, and currently I'm the president and chairman of the Shishmaref Native Corporation, and I also work for the Native Village of Shishmaref. Shishmaref is located on the northern end of the Seward Peninsula, north of Nome. We're on a barrier island, quarter mile wide by 3 miles long, and for the past 50, 60 years or so, we've been having erosion problems. You know, in the past few years, since the rise of the sea level, our erosion problem has been getting worse and worse. In the fall of 1997, October, we had a real bad storm, and as a result of that storm and the loss of land in the following 2 or 3 years, we eventually moved about, I think, like 21 homes or 22 to keep them from falling into the sea. It makes me sad in a way, but, you know, we have to plan for the future for our younger generation. You know, we need to try to keep our traditions going, you know, our culture value, our subsistence way of life, you know, and continue living in this area, you know, and something that our community need to consider when we have to plan to move. Otherwise, we're going to be forced to relocate in other areas, you know. Our everyday thing is different, you know, through the seasons. You know, we hunt, we fish, we gather berries, gather greens. And a lot of us, we consider that our recreational activity, but it's something that we do and we have fun doing. I think the oldest carbon dating that they've ever done here is like 4,000 years, but I know we've been here longer than that. I know some people on the east side of us are always saying, we've been here 10,000 years, you know. So if they've been there 10,000 years, then they had to pass by us. So we've probably been here for 15, 20,000 years.
Tony Weowana Sr. is president of the Shishmaref Native Corporation. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Matt Miller, Jolene Almendarez, Annie Feit, and David Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Emily Files.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu in Juneau and Aaron Selbig in Homer. Emily Files was our AK guest host this week. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Providence Imaging Center, with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology, provimaging.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.